Okay, the title of my sermon is, May God's Will Be Done, just as we heard in the opening prayer. May God's will be done. Jesus taught his disciples several important principles, and one of them had to do with how to pray. And in that model prayer, or a prayer outline, he reminded them that they need to pray for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now, God is certainly able to exert his will on earth. And you can turn to Isaiah 46 if you want to. I'm going to read it. I think I've got it written down here. I'm going to read it. And it says, remember, Isaiah 46, verses 9 through 10, remember the former things of old, for I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning. So God knew from the beginning what was going to happen. Not maybe every specific detail, but in general. And saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. So God is able to exert his will on this earth. He doesn't force us to make decisions, though. He lets us have freedom of choice. But when God wants something to be done, he is able to get it done. And so in today's sermon, I want to look at two examples of how God's will had been done in unusual circumstances. And then I want to take a look a little bit about our country, the United States, and how it came into being and what is happening to it now. So let's first take a look at a couple of examples. They show some of God's great power and even his humor. So if you will, turn to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 16. Give you a little bit of background. It's about Saul pursuing David. David had been chosen by Saul, or some of Saul's inner court, I guess, to come and play a harp for him and help him out with various things. Been highly recommended, and Saul was pleased with him for a long time, even had his daughter, gave his daughter to David in marriage. But Saul became jealous of David, and I'm not going to go into the details, but Saul lost God's Holy Spirit that was with him, and David gained that Holy Spirit, and so David began to be blessed, and Saul was not. So Saul got more and more jealous of David, and he saw in David a threat to the throne, which was, in fact, you know, a little bit of truth to that. Although David wouldn't take it, but David would be the next king. So let's look at 1 Samuel in chapter 16, starting in verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, and this is when, now this is a little bit different introduction, but in this particular case, God is telling Samuel to go and anoint David. And so he goes to the house of Jesse, and Jesse has a lot of men, children, or a lot of boy children. And so he is going through them one by one. The Lord said to Samuel in verse 7, do not look at the appearance of or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. Talking about one of the men who looked pretty good to Samuel. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so that's one of the problems in our election, too. We oftentimes look at the outward appearance and don't have the ability to look at the heart like God does. Now let's go down to verse 11. So Samuel said to Jesse, are these all all the young men here. And he said, there remains yet the youngest. And there he is keeping the sheep. Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes. So they brought him, and he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking. The Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. And Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah. So David is anointed to be king over Israel. Now, Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin, but David was of the tribe of Judah, something that's easy to overlook. But in Genesis 49, and you might want to turn back there for a minute, Genesis 49, verse 10, this is Jacob's last words to his sons. He made some prophecies, especially about Joseph, but this is what he said about Judah. Genesis 49, verse 9. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down. He lies down as a lion. Who can rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, means a kingship, nor a lawyer from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. Well, in our United Church of God's Old Testament Bible commentary on that, it says we know that a cessation of kings would descend from Judah till a specified time, that is, until the Savior, Jesus Christ, comes. And so it says, since the royal line would exist until the last days, the coming of Shiloh here must indicate Christ's second coming. It says, indeed, this prophecy explains that Christ will assume the throne of Judah in the end time, meaning that there has to be a throne of kings of Jewish descent in existence for him to return to. And there is. And I'll just give you a source to go to on that if you want to. I think for those of you who have internet access, this is a good source. Those of you who don't, I don't know. I suppose I could make a copy of this thing maybe and bring it and circulate it if you want to, but it's called The Throne of Britain, Its Biblical Origin and Future. Throne of Britain, Its Biblical Origin and Future. And you can find that. It's an e-booklet on our website. It's got a lot of interesting information. And some of that I'll just give you briefly. Talks about when the king of Babylon invaded Judah and they destroyed the temple. They killed the king, or didn't kill the king. Zedekiah put out his eyes. They killed his sons. All of his sons were dead, but he had some daughters left. And so Jeremiah took one of the daughters, Jeremiah the prophet, and went over to Ireland. Northern part of Ireland, where she married the king over there. And you might say, well, what is an Irish king doing marrying this Jewish girl? Actually, there were two lines of from Judah. One was Perez and the other was Zerah. You remember, Zerah was the one with the red thing on her hand. And that's the line that she married into. And so there was a transfer at that time of the scepter from the line of Perez to Zerah. And it still was in Judah's lineage. And so the line remains in the throne of Britain today. Jeannie and I had an opportunity several years ago to go over to London, and we went down to Westminster Abbey, and there was the chair that they coronated kings on, but there was no stone in it. The stone of Scone, that's what it's supposed to be. And they explained that it was in Scotland now, which it is in Edinburgh, Scotland. But it had been for many, many years in England. And that's the stone that they coronated kings and queens on. It's supposed to be Jacob's pillar stone, if you remember that. So what I was just trying to say is there was the lineage of Judah that began with King David and will last until the time when Christ returns. Okay, so getting back to 1 Samuel again, go to 1 Samuel 19. Now we'll get into when Saul was chasing David. Saul tried many different things to get rid of David, including having David go out and kill a number of Philistines and take their foreskins, which David accomplished, brought them back, and that was his kind of his dowry for being able to marry his daughter. But there were other things in 1 Samuel 19, verse 1. Saul said to Jonathan, his son, and to all of his servants, that they should kill David. So this is, he's making this pretty well known that he wants David out of the picture. But Jonathan, Saul's sons, delighted greatly in David. David and Jonathan were very good friends. Jonathan, in fact, had a great deal of character. And so he probably would have made a good king, but it didn't work out that way. But Jonathan certainly didn't want David dead, although Saul did. And down in verse 10, when David was in Saul's presence, sometimes he would play the harp and so forth and make Saul feel better. His bad spirit would leave him. But this particular time, it says in verse 10, Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear. But he, as David, slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So the wall wasn't made out of the same things that we make walls out of today, so it must have thrown it pretty hard. And so David escaped that night. And in verse 11, Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, that's Saul's daughter, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. And so she loved David, and even though she was Saul's daughter, she cared enough about David to try to protect him from Saul. And so what Michal did is made an image and put it in the bed there and pretended that it was David. And so messengers finally came down, and she said, he's sick. And so they went over to the bed and found out it wasn't David at all. And so Saul was very angry about that. But David escaped. In verse 18, David fled and escaped and went to Saul at Ramah and told him that all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. Now, Naoth is a little area which was the school for prophets. Saul, like Elijah, had a school for prophets and was training them, I guess, in helping him with preaching the truth to the children of Israel. And so Saul decided that he would send messengers down there to take David. And he said that in verse 20, Saul sent messengers to take David. But an interesting thing happened. You know, they had the orders from the king to take him, just any way they could, I suppose. It says, and when they saw the group of prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Now you might wonder what this prophecy consists of. Probably the best explanation that I read, anyway, was in Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary. You know, prophesying can mean actually predicting the future. It could mean inspired speaking, or it can mean inspired singing, praising songs. So this is what the commentary, JFB commentary, said. The character of the place and the influence of the sacred exercises produced such an effect on them that they were incapable of discharging their commission and were led by a restless impulse to join in singing the praises of God. And so maybe that's what they did. Or maybe they prophesied, actually. At any rate, they went back to Saul without David. And so Saul tried this three different times with no luck. And so Saul decided he would go down there himself and get David. In verse 22, then he also went to Ramah and so forth and so on. And he said, where are Samuel and David? Someone said they are at Naoth and Ramah. And so he went there to Naoth and Ramah. And the Spirit of God was upon him also. Now consider this, that an evil spirit had been troubling Saul. And now the Spirit of God was upon him. Isn't that interesting? And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naoth Ramah. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner, lay down naked all that night. Well, according to Barnes' notes, it wasn't naked, it's just his outer clothes he'd taken off, probably warm. And therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? It's interesting, isn't it? Saul had an intent to kill David. He was not his friend at all, but yet God was able to turn that around to where there was nothing done at all. Saul went down there and sent his probably his best soldiers down there. Same thing happened to all of them. Came back without David. That's because God's will was for David to be king. And so David became king. That's what God's will was. And so he was able to accomplish that, even with a little bit of humor, don't you think? There's another case of that. That's in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 6. Second Kings chapter 6. And starting in verse 8. And this is a case where the king of Syria was trying to make war with Israel, probably sending out some small groups here and there to attack at various places. But he wasn't having much success. Now, the king of Syria was making war with Israel, and he consulted with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. And the man of God sent to the king of Israel, that's Elisha here, sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. So God apparently would reveal this information to Elisha, and he would pass it on to the king of Israel. In verse 11, therefore the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, called his servants and said, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? So he thought there was a conspirator in their midst. But that wasn't the case. It said, one of the servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. And so he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and get him. So he thought, like Saul did, that it'd just be easy to go down and get him. After all, he's one man, maybe with a helper or two. So they told him he was in Dothan. And therefore, in 14, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there. And they came by night and surrounded the city. You'd think it's a done deal. When the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was the army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? Here we are surrounded, and it's just you and me. And so he answered, Elisha had a lot of faith. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine yourself in this position as Elisha? So he answered and said, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with him. And so his helper looked around and he thought, well, Elisha's not very good at math, right? And Elisha prayed, and said, Lord, I pray, open the eyes, his eyes, that he may see. And so it was a miracle from God. The Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, behold, a mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So there were quite a few people around Elisha, quite a few angels, you might say. So when Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord. Again, a second miracle. He said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. And he struck them with blindness, according to the word of Elisha. So far, not a shot has been fired, right? No arrows have been slung. No swords have been drawn. Perfectly peaceful. And Elisha said to them, now that they were blind, said, this is not the way, nor is this the city. You know, this is not where you need to be. I'll lead you. I'll lead you where you need to be, okay? And so they followed him. He led them to Samaria. That's the capital of the northern kingdom. And so it was in verse 20, when they had come to Samaria, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So another miracle. And God opened their eyes of this army, and they saw, and they were inside Samaria. And they were captured. You know, last thing that they knew, they were there trying to capture Elisha, and the next thing they know is they're captured themselves, and they're inside the city, capital city of Samaria. So, quite a change there for these fellows. Now, when the king of Israel saw them, he said, Elisha, my father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Which seemed like a good idea to him, probably. But Elisha said, you shall not kill them. Would you kill those whom you have taken captive with your sword and bow? So, if you know, the practice was whenever they took people captive, they didn't kill them. They fed them and so forth, like most countries do today. And so he said, set food and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. And then he prepared a great feast for them. After they ate and drank, he sent them away. They went to their master. And what happened? He said, so the bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. It's not a good idea to go into Israel. They got some power, mysterious power down in there, right? God was able to protect them and keep them safe, even though the Syrian army was there. And they didn't even come back into the land of Israel for quite a while. Well, since God is the same yesterday and today and forever, and since he's impartial, doesn't it seem like that we can have trust and confidence in God that he'll grant us a similar kind of protection if we are his servants? Does that make sense? After all, Jesus Christ knew that, before he went to be crucified, he could have had access to 12 legions of angels, 72,000, according to my reckoning. And we know that angels watch over us today, right? Matthew 18, verse 10. And Jesus is talking about a child now. We have the blessing of the little children, usually after the Feast of Tabernacles, shortly after, and ask God to set his angels about the children so that they are protected from various things. And this is what it says in Matthew 18, verse 10. Jesus said, take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. So, they've got angels who go back and forth from God's throne to watch over small children. Watch over us, perhaps. Hebrews 13, verse 2. Hebrews 13, verse 2. Hebrews 13, verse 2 says, do not forget to entertain strangers. That doesn't mean somebody who is coming in and drunk and disorderly and whatever. You know, somebody who's a decent human being. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. How about that? Wonder if you ever did that. Wonder if any of us ever did that. Entertained an angel, we didn't know about it. Be a good thing if we had, wouldn't it? So, God can protect us even today, just as he protected Elisha and his servant. Turn to Proverbs 16, verse 7. And this is what Solomon wrote, 16, verse 7. And the key there is whether or not we're pleasing God with our life. It says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Isn't that great? That's comforting to know that, isn't it? But the key is we got to please God. So God can deliver people in a multitude of ways. And we just went over a couple of unusual ways. God did show his great power, was able to do that without a shot being fired, was able to do that in a very peaceful way, brought about a great amount of good. Now I want to talk about the United States a little bit. So turn to Genesis 48, if you will. Genesis 48. Jacob blessed Joseph's sons. Genesis 48 and verse 17. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who was coming to Jacob to have them blessed. Jacob, who couldn't see very well, put his right hand on Ephraim's head. Ephraim was the youngest, put his left hand on Manasseh's head. Manasseh was the oldest. Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. Jacob knew what he was doing. His father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. So Manasseh was going to be a great people. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So if you think about that prophecy and think about, I guess, the world-ruling kingdoms and the various nations that have existed down through time, might think of what was the greatest multitude of nations, the greatest empire, you might say, that the world has ever seen. Well, this is what our Bible commentary said. This is from UCG's Bible commentary on the Old Testament. It said, prior to America's greatness, Britain ruled over the largest empire in the history of the world. Manasseh today is the United States of America, the greatest single nation the world has ever seen. Or as Wikipedia says, I don't often use it as a source, but I guess it's fairly good. At least it is in this particular case. It says, at its height, the British Empire was the largest empire in history. For over a century, it was the foremost global power. Can you imagine that today? Look at Great Britain today. You wouldn't say the same thing of them today, would you? By 1922, the British Empire held sway over about 458 million people, 1/5 of the world's population at the time, covered more than 13 million square miles, almost a quarter of the Earth's total land area. And it was true that the sun never set on the British Empire. You know, they had colonies and lands all around the globe. So it was the greatest empire in the history of the world, British Empire. And we know that today, still yet, but it's waning, the United States is the greatest nation the world has ever seen. Now, let's go to Genesis 49 and see what Jacob prophesies that was going to happen to Joseph's descendants in the last days. Genesis 49. Well, actually, let's read the first verse because that's what it says. Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." So that was not for the immediate future. That was for our time now. Our time now. Now look at verse 22. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by the well. His branches run over the wall. Means he's going to be a colonizing nation. Archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. You know, people have hated the British Empire and Britain and the United States today, but they remained strong because of their military might. It's because of the... It says, "And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob." So, then he goes on to give him the blessings. And he says in verse 25, "By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above." So there's to be ample rain and dew, favorable weather, for growing crops, livestock, and other vegetation. God is still blessing this nation today with generally good weather and rain. Although there's a drought in California, I know it's been going on for a while. We'll see what happens with that. And occasionally we do have disasters like hurricanes and so forth, tornadoes. But generally we have good weather still yet. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that we're doing with the crops that we have. We have products that many products that are genetically modified. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. Called GMOs, genetically modified organisms. You use a lot of Roundup too in crops. Roundup's used in wheat just prior to harvest. Kills the wheat, kills all the weeds too, and makes harvesting a little bit easier. But these are some things, just some facts about GMOs I picked up on the internet that might be interesting for you. A gene from a spider that helps it produce silk, for example, could be inserted into the DNA of an ordinary goat. So you got a goat mating with a spider, right? That may sound far-fetched, but the exact process was used to breed goats that produce silk proteins in their goat milk. The milk is then harvested, and the silk protein is isolated to make a lightweight, ultra-strong silk with a wide range of industrial and medical uses. You think that's fairy tales, but that's not. That's science today. Tomatoes have been developed that resist frost and freezing temperatures with antifreeze genes from a cold water fish, the winter flounder. So they've crossed a tomato with a fish. Food and Drug Administration also recently approved potatoes that don't bruise and apples that don't brown. Isn't that neat? The apples have been genetically engineered, reducing levels of enzyme that cause browning or bruising. So, that's technology today. By far, the biggest use of GMO technology has been in large-scale agricultural crops. At least 90% of the soy, cotton, canola, corn, sugar beets give us most of the sugar that we have, in the United States have been genetically engineered. The adoption of herbicide-resistant corn, which has been slower in previous years, has accelerated, reaching 90% U.S. corn acreage, according to USDA. One widely used method of incorporating insect resistance into plants, and see, this is what they do with the GMOs, so they don't have to spray them so much. Insect resistance into plants through the gene for toxin, poison, production found in the bacterium Bacillus thuringiensis, BT for short. According to the World Health Organization, GMO crops that are modified with the BT gene have a proven resistance to insect pests, thus reducing the need for wide-scale spraying of synthetic pesticides. So they put a gene in there that's got kind of poison, so that if an insect bites the plant, it dies. So later on, you bite the plant and you're still alive, you know. Anyway, that's kind of what's happened with the blessings that God has given us. We're tinkering around with them a little bit too much. And some scientists and doctors believe that there's a direct relationship between the increased amount of GMOs that we consume, either directly or through animals who've been fed GMOs, that's causing an increase in cancer. But the USDA doesn't go for that. They don't believe that. All right. Blessings of the heavens above. Blessings of the deep that lies under. That's talking about springs and rivers and lakes and seas in the earth. The United States has two seas on each coast, east and west coast, the Gulf of Mexico. Lots of rivers. Lots of beautiful lakes and streams and springs and so forth. Here in Arkansas, we're blessed with a lot of that natural beauty and something that is good for us. Drinking a lot of the spring water from various sources here. Okay, but one of the things that all the water, especially the salt water, has in it is seafood. And a few years ago, we went to feast and went to Prince Edward Island, which is in Canada. It's on the eastern part of Canada. And met some people from Newfoundland and found out that Newfoundland used to be have a very good fishing industry there. A lot of codfish there. Most of that has been fished out, not only by Americans, but by other countries as well. And so that industry has kind of gone by the wayside. Young people growing up will try to find other things to do. Newfoundland, if you recall, during 9/11, was one of the nice places that gave us a place to land for their airport. And I think it's St. John's, perhaps that area. And some of the neighboring people around there opened up their homes. Churches opened up their churches for us to have places to stay. People were on those planes trying to get away from New York. And so they're very nice and friendly people there. But at any rate, their fishing industry is not so good anymore. I heard something on television just the other night about fishing in Maine, too, and it's a similar thing. So not quite as good as it used to be. And the government is limiting our use of fossil fuels. That's a big drive right now. And, of course, we have quite a bit of coal reserves in this country, quite a bit of oil and quite a bit of natural gas, but we're trying to get away from that and go more to the cleaner energy, I guess, of wind energy and other types of energy that don't consume fossil fuels. So the blessings of the deep that lies under, we're not availing ourselves of all of those. I think those were good to use. A lot of it has to do with how we use them, and we can process them in ways that don't pollute the environment too much, but we're just not doing that. And a third blessing was the blessing of the breast and the womb. And that has to do with having numerous and healthy descendants, as well as herds of livestock, cattle, sheep, and so forth. But now in this country, you see a lot of abortion, you know, over 58 million babies have been aborted since Roe versus Wade. Same-sex marriage, not going to have too many offspring off of that. LGBT is beginning to make inroads. And then, of course, in our cattle and livestock, we're fed various things that are probably not very good for us either, like growth hormones and so forth. So the blessings, the point I was trying to make is the blessings that God has given us, we are not taking advantage of, and we're turning those into curses, really. Now, God blessed this nation with good government, liberty, and freedom. And as the Declaration of Independence shows, we started out with very good ideas. This is how it begins, the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's a good start. That they are endowed by their Creator, not by anybody else, with certain unalienable rights. That are among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was a good start, wasn't it? Good government. And it ended with this. And with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, God, in other words, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. And so that's what the founders had to say. I want to read to you, I just saw this ad. This is an ad in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, July 4th. I think they've run this ad at least two or three years in a row now. It's put out by Hobby Lobby and Mardell's. Incidentally, it says that you can download a free Bible for your phone here. So if you have not the kind of phone that I have, but if you have a smartphone, you can download a Bible to it and free, apparently, that website. This is, just read a few quotes of our founding fathers. What I'm trying to do is compare what our nation used to be like with what it's like today. This is from Benjamin Franklin. He said, "I've lived a long time, sir, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. I firmly believe this. I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." So, Benjamin Franklin basically said, we need God. We need God's assistance in this. Would a government leader say that today? This is what George Washington said, first president. "It's the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will." Imagine that. Obey God. "Be grateful for his benefits and humbly implore his protection and favor." Well, we may implore God's favor, but that's probably about it. This is a good quote from the original justice of the Supreme Court. This is what people back in those days thought who were serving on the Supreme Court. "Human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law which is divine." Ooh, Ten Commandments, right? "Far from being rivals or enemies, religion and law are twin sisters, friends, and mutual assistants. Indeed, these two sciences run into each other." So, I don't know how many of the justices on the Supreme Court today would agree with that. Not too many, I would guess. Probably not the majority, for sure. Here's one from the Yale Student Guidelines. This is a long time ago. Remember, colleges like Yale and Harvard and so forth were begun primarily for purposes of teaching ministers and spreading word about God's, about the Bible. All the scholars, this is from Yale, all the scholars are required to live a religious and blameless life. No partying late at night, you know, no orgies and stuff like that. According to the rules of God's Word. Oh, can you imagine that? Diligently reading the Holy Scriptures, that fountain of divine light and truth. So that's what the folks at Yale thought back once upon a time. I doubt if they have quite the same feeling today. And this last one, which I thought was especially true. See, we have a government here in this country that gives us a great deal of freedom. And we as people, whether or not we choose to accept it, have a great deal of responsibility because of that. This is what John Adams said. We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Now, in places like China, they do have a government armed with power, capable of contending with human passions. But they don't here in this country. He says, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And that's true. So, if the morals and religions fade, then our government is not going to help us. You know, it's going to be a hindrance. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 28, if you will. Deuteronomy 28. There are two chapters in the Bible which probably wouldn't hurt to refer to once in a while. Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, national blessings and cursings that God gave Israel. It applies to Israel, and so it applies to the descendants of Joseph today. It applies to our country. In verse 43, Deuteronomy 28, verse 43, he's talking about various things that would happen for because of our disobedience. He says, the alien, now that's people who are non-Israelite, who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, you shall be the tail. The United States used to be the greatest lender in the world. Now we're the greatest debtor in the world. The Chinese government, we owe them a great deal, you know, trillions of dollars. The Japanese also have quite a bit loaned here to us. So right now we've got strong dollar and things look fairly good, so forth. But if something should happen that these countries decide not to invest in the United States anymore, we've got a problem, don't we? Because we're very deep in debt. So it's prophesied, and that's going to happen. Now, Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 12. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 12. This is God telling Isaiah what to say. And he says, as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. I wanted to read that today because a couple of things had happened in the news recently. One was in Great Britain. There had been a couple of fellows, I guess, that were being considered to replace David Cameron, who resigned. But they decided that they didn't want to be prime ministers either. And so there are two women vying for that job. And one of them is favored. Her name is Theresa May. So Mrs. May, she may be the new Prime Minister of Britain. Now, Margaret Thatcher was a pretty good Prime Minister of Britain. I don't know what about Mrs. May, but she may be the new Prime Minister. And in this country, it's likely now, I would say, Mrs. Clinton has passed a big hurdle, and it's very likely, I think, that she's going to be the next president here. Polls say she has the majority over Mr. Trump, so we'll see. But anyway, that's what it said. Women and children rule over them. And we do have some people in places of authority that don't have the experience that they should have, I guess, various ways. All right, Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, verse 14. Isaiah 59, verse 14. Says, justice is turned back. You know, if you try to get justice in this world, what you need to have is a good attorney and a lot of money or influence. And righteousness stands afar off, for truth is fallen in the street. Just about. Truth is fallen in the street. And equity cannot enter. So truth fails. Truth is failing in this country, isn't it? All you have to do is listen to the two individuals who are running for president. If you hear truth, you know it's an exception, I think. He who departs from evil makes himself a prey. So people who stand up for what is good, the decent man and so forth, you're doing that at your own peril. You make yourself a prey. Now, if you will, turn to 2 Peter. 2 Peter, Hebrews. 2 Peter 3 and verse 8. 2 Peter 3 and verse 8. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. So we've often talked about that in God's church, about being 7 days, the seventh day being the millennium, 7,000 years, man's existence on earth. And I looked up in the Bullinger's Companion Bible, and this is rough estimates. But from creation to Abraham's calling was about 2,000 years. And from Abraham to Christ was about 2,000 years. And from Christ to the end of the age is about 2,000 years. Now, don't know exactly when Bullinger was counting. I know that he has a very detailed chart, but didn't pay that much attention to it. But I know Christ began his ministry at the age of 30. He died in about 31 A.D., so, 2,000 years, I would say that would make 2030 at the outside. Anyway, we're approaching the end of the age, and we saw some things that happened in this week on the news, two more shootings of young black men by police, and then some protests in various parts of the country, and then willful shooting of white policemen down in Dallas. So we're looking at a very difficult time in the country's history, a lot of division, and we need somebody to help bring us together, but it doesn't look to me like there's anybody on the scene that's going to do that. So headed for some difficult times, I believe. Now turn to Philippians. Philippians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians. Philippians 1, verse 3 through 7. This is what Paul said. He said, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine, making requests for you all with joy for your fellowship in the gospel for the first day until now, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. So God's going to complete the work in you that he has begun. Says, Bible says that if we endure to the end, we'll be saved. Didn't say that the end's going to be great. Didn't say that we were not going to go through trials and difficulties and so forth. And what we see happening on our streets now, and I think the result of our next election and the things that have happened over in Britain are all going to be negative for a while. But we do have hope that Jesus Christ will return and that he is working through us. He's promised to bless Israel, and he has done so, carried out his promises. Now Israel is turning his back on God, and so he's withdrawing his blessings. Still blessed quite a bit, you know, regardless. But God keeps his promises. God can carry out his will in unsuspected ways, just like he did with David and Saul, just like he did with Elisha. He has the power to do that. And he has the power to protect us even in difficult times. It's God's will that he has called us to be in his kingdom. And if we endure and humbly try to please and obey him, God will carry out his will with each of us. And so may God's will be done in our lives.